partial devastation that just took place in the previous Manvantara period. So the person who got the service of repopulating the world was Daksha, and Daksha's service is to, you know, create all kinds of living entities, demigods, humans, plants, animals, which is a little different than the way we're normally understood about how living entities come to the world. Generally, when there's reproduction taking place, generally you're reproducing of a living entity of the same kind. So like humans were to reproduce, they would generally have human offspring. But Daksha is able to have offspring of all kinds of different kinds of living entities. The way it explains that, you know, we have genes, which are made of DNA, which are like the blueprint for the kind of body of that particular living entity. So the genes of the male and the genes of the female, they combine, and they combine to produce information for the developing embryo of that particular species. That's how it generally works with living entities here on planet Earth. Vedic understanding is that they don't use the word genes, but they use the word seed. So like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that he's the seed-giving father. And in one sense you can say that he kind of gave all the seeds to Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is like the first created living being in this material universe. And within him, he can create all the different types of living entities because he has all the seeds that were given to him by Krishna. And like that, because he has ability to have all the seeds of all the different kinds of living entities, he can produce all the different kinds of living entities. And one of the living entities he produces is Daksha, whose responsibility is to produce more living entities. So Daksha has within himself also these seeds, which Prabhupada describes as being like little machines which are meant to design different bodies. So Daksha is trying to do this. He's trying to perform the service of creating, repopulating the world. And he ran into a little bit of difficulty. He tried to do it mentally, and things weren't coming out right. So he went, you know, he decided, okay, I need to perform some austerities to really be able to do the service properly. So he started performing severe austerities, and as part of those severe austerities, we're hearing, he said these Hansa Guhya prayers, which is where we're at now. So the progression of the prayers, it starts by describing that the Lord is transcendental, and the conditioned living entities, they have a hard time understanding the Lord being transcendental, because, you know, the example was given of just how the sense objects cannot understand the senses, because the senses are more subtle than the sense objects. Similarly, the living entity cannot really understand the Supreme Lord, because, you know, the Supreme Lord is transcendental to, you know, material nature, and the living entity is conditioned by the material nature. So then it talks about what are the qualifications of one who can see the Supreme Lord? That's what we'll talk about today, and then how do you get those qualifications? You know, future verses, and then it just goes on to glorify the Lord. Okay, so today we'll do text 26. Yado paramo manaso namarupa namarupasya drishta smriti sampramoshat yayate kevalaya svasangstaya namsaya dasmai shuchi sadmane namaha namsaya dasmai shuchi Nyanoparamo manaso namarupa Rupa smirishta smriti sampramoshat Niyate kevalaya susamstaya Amsaya tasmai shuchi sadmane namah. Minaparamo manaso namarupa Rupa sadhishta smriti sampramoshat Niyate kevalaya susamstaya Namsaya tasmai shuchi sadmane namaha. Namparamo manaso namaha. Namparishta smriti sampramoshat. Nayate kevalaya susamstaya. Tasmai shuchi sadmane namah. Nidhuparamo manaso rupa. Rupa sadhishta smriti sampramoshat. Nite kevalaya sasamstaya. Amsaya tasmai shuchi sadmane namah. Nuparamo manaso namarupa. Rupa sadhishta smriti sampramoshat. Niyate kevalaya sasamstaya. Amsaya tasmai shuchi sadmane namah. Yada. When in trance, uparamaha, complete cessation, manasa, of the mind, nama rupa, material names and forms, rupasya, of that by which they appear, Drishta, of material vision, Smriti, and of remembrance, Sampramoshat, due to the destruction, Nya, who, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Niyate, is perceived, Kevalaya, with spiritual, Svasangstaya, his own original form, Hamsaya, unto the Supreme Pure, Tasmai, unto him, Shuchi Sadmane, who is realized only in the pure state of spiritual existence. Namaha, I offer my respectful obeisances. Translation, purport. When one's consciousness is completely purified of the contamination of material existence, gross and subtle, without being agitated, as in the working and dreaming states, and when the mind is not dissolved, as in Sushupti, deep sleep, one comes to the platform of trance. Then, one's material vision and the memories of the mind, which manifest names and forms, are vanquished. Only in such a trance is the Supreme Personality of Godhead revealed. Thus let us offer our respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is seen in that uncontaminated transcendental state. Purport. There are two stages of God realization. One is called sugyeyam, or very easily understood, generally by mental speculation, and the other is called durgyeyam, understood only with difficulty. Paramatma realization and Brahman realization are considered sugyayam, but realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is durgyayam. As described here, one attains the ultimate realization of the Personality of Godhead when one gives up the activities of the mind, thinking, feeling, and willing, or in other words, when one stops, when mental speculation stops. This transcendental realization is above Sushupti, deep sleep. In our gross conditional stage, we perceive things through material experience and remembrance, and in the subtle stage, we perceive the world in dreams. The process of vision also involves remembrance and also exists in a subtle form. Above gross experience and dreams is Sushupti, deep sleep. And when one comes to the completely spiritual platform, transcending deep sleep, he attains trance, Shuddha Sattva or Vasudeva Sattva, in which the Personality of Godhead is revealed. Ata Sri Krishna Namadi Na Bhaved Grahyam Indriyai. As long as one is situated in duality, on the central platform, gross or subtle, realization of the original Personality of Godhead is impossible. Sevan Mukhe Hi Jivado Svayam Eva Sparatyadaha. But when one engages his senses in the service of the Lord, specifically when one engages the tongue in chanting the Hare Krishna mantra and tasting only Krishna prasad with the spirit of service, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is revealed. This is indicated in this verse by the word Shuchi Sadmane. Shuchi means purified. By the spirit of rendering service with one's senses, one's entire existence becomes Shuchi Sadma, the platform of uncontaminated purity. Daksha therefore offers his respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is revealed on the platform of Shuchi Sadma. In this regard, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes the following prayer by Lord Brahma from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, 14th chapter, text 6, Tatapi Bhuman, Mahima Gunasya Te Vibodhum, Arhatyam Malantar Atmabihi. Quote, one whose heart has become completely purified, my Lord, can understand the transcendental qualities of your Lordship and can understand the greatness of your activities. End quote. Okay, so I was looking for this word Sushupti in the translation, or in the verse. I found it in the translation, but not in the Sanskrit. So Prabhupada, I guess, seemingly put that in there. Because it's describing like a progression of states of consciousness. Prabhupada is describing a progressive states of consciousness, starting from most gross to the most subtle. So the most gross state of consciousness being the waking state of consciousness, where one is working, engaging different activities. And then in this state, the mind is agitated. Then there's a little bit more subtle state of consciousness where one is dreaming, or they're having visions, or they're remembering something. So this is like a more subtle state of consciousness. And in this state of consciousness, one's mind is agitated. Then there's a little bit more subtle state of consciousness, which is Sushupti, deep sleep, where you're just kind of, the mind isn't agitated so much, but the mind's not really thinking of anything in this state, more or less. So in one sense, it's a little higher in the sense that the mind isn't agitated, but it's not the highest because the mind isn't thinking about something positive. And then the highest stage of consciousness, I guess, is trance, where one's mind is not agitated, but at the same time, the mind is thinking about the Lord. So this is the progression of consciousness here. So in order to be able to see the Lord or have the Lord be revealed to you, it's giving us a very high bar for such things to occur. We just have to be pure state of spiritual existence, uncontaminated. We have to be in a transcendental state, completely pure in heart. We have to dissolve our material mind, or the material mind has to be dissolved. No more thinking about material memories. No, you can't, you're not thinking about material names and forms. No, you stop mental speculation, and you know. So it's seeing the Lord is, you know, it seems like we're never going to see the Lord because it's such a, like a, we're so far from, at least most of us are so far from this that it seems like so it's such a difficult thing to be able to get to. So one can ask the question, though, you know, like, sometimes devotees have the experience of seeing the Lord in dreams, for example. You know, and Prabhupada said, you know, if we drink a glass of hot milk and read Krishna book before going to bed, we can dream of Krishna. So one can ask, well, are those, is that seeing Krishna? I'm not, obviously I'm not a pure devotee, I'm, you know, still thinking about material things. And but nevertheless, I had this dream the other night where Krishna appeared. Devotees have this experience. So one can ask, is that seeing Krishna? Not exactly. So if you do have, if you do end up having like a dream of Krishna or something, Prabhupada said that you can consider yourself fortunate for having such a dream. And you can take it as like an auspicious transcendental sign or something, but really Prabhupada said that you shouldn't put much importance when it comes to dreams. You know, the way dreams work is that you have these impressions that are stored in the mind, not only from this life, but of unlimited lives, practically. And then they act like bubbles. Like if you have a carbonated beverage or something, and all these bubbles are just coming up. So similarly, in the mind, there's all these bubbles that are just coming up, different impressions. So you might have the experience, Prabhupada gives a classic example, but you might have the experience of seeing a mountain, and you might have the experience of seeing gold. So in your dream, you might see a golden mountain. Or if sometimes people dream of flying or something. So you might have the impression of, oh, like I was a bird in my last life, or I was a demigod in my last life, or something. So you have that impression of what it's like. So that's kind of like what dreams are, is just these impressions that are coming up. So they're, you know, so I guess, again, it's not like the, you know, something to be considered too seriously. So here it says that there's two stages of God realization. There's Sugyeyam and Durgyeyam. Sugyeyam means very easily understood. And it's kind of clarified here in these parentheses, generally by mental speculation. And Durgyeyam is understood only with great difficulty. So Brahman realization and Paramatma realization fall into the Surgyeyam category, meaning they're easily understood. And Durgyeyam and Bhagavan realization falls into the Durgyeyam category, meaning it's difficult to understand. Which is interesting because Bhagavan realization generally, like when we come to Krishna consciousness, we often hear that, oh, it's so easy, this whole, you know, becoming, practicing Krishna consciousness, it's so easy, all you gotta do is chant Hare Krishna and, you know, it's natural, we're persons, Supreme Lord is a person, therefore, you know, you'd think it'd be easier to realize Bhagavan. But here we're hearing that, Brahman realization and Paramatma realization, they're actually easy to understand. And Bhagavan realization is difficult to come to. So how can we understand that? When it comes to Brahman realization, we're realizing like the Sat feature of Brahman. It's like the eternity feature. So sometimes people can come to the understanding of, oh, there's some eternal existence. You know, they might have some conception of some being eternal, or they might understand that they're eternal. So sometimes we might be asked the question, well, how do you know that you are eternal? This is a fair question. You know, how do you know that you're eternal? We say that we kind of take it for granted as devotees that we're eternal, but we can ask the question, how do you know that you're eternal? And the best answer for this is, you know you're eternal because everyone is trying to become eternal. So where does that desire come from to become eternal, to go on and on and on? So that because we're trying to become eternal, that's indication that, well, it's actually quality of the soul. It's kind of part of who we are. So anyway, so Brahman, in terms of like mental speculation, one might be able to come to the conclusion, okay, maybe we're eternal. That's the idea, that you might be able to come to these conclusions using your mental faculties, potentially. And even paramama realization, it's possible to come to the conclusion that there might be such a thing as paramatma using mental speculation. And Prabhupada gives an example of how this can be done in the second canto. There's this verse there where he describes how even a common man can understand the presence of the Supersoul as like the guiding source of intelligence, you know, in the body. And he can do this by introspection. And he gives like the whole, like, here's how to do it. So here's how any common man can understand the presence of the Supersoul in the body, or presence of the Supersoul in general. First, you start by realizing that you exist. You know, that you identify with something, that you have this capacity to identify as something, that's one, and then that you exist. That's the first stage, I guess, of coming to the realization that, oh, that there could be such a thing as paramatma, that you exist. Then you can understand that you're not at least the limbs of this body. You're not this body, more or less. You're not, at least not the limbs. Like, that's, most people can come to understand this point just with a little bit of reasoning. Like, if you cut off your finger and you say, okay, well, obviously I'm not that finger because I'm still here and existing and that finger's not me. So you can come to that conclusion that people, okay, they accept that. That's next step, I guess, that you exist and that you're a little different than the limbs of your body. I saw this video some time ago. There's this street philosophy. I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen it. There's this guy who goes around and he asks people on the street these philosophical questions. And I happened to watch the video where this guy was asking the question, who are you? He went up to people and said, who are you? You know, Jayajagannath does this too on book distribution, but it starts like an interesting discussion sometimes. So, who are you? And then people, usually they give their name, such and such. Can you point to yourself? And they're like, what do you mean? You know. And then usually most adults, most of the time they point to their head nowadays. You know, when people say, point to yourself, they point to their head. Whereas when you ask like a kid, you know, if you do this, you can do this exercise sometimes with kids. You can say, point to your nose. And then they'll go like this. Point to your leg. Point to your ear. And then you say, point to you. And then they kind of like, it does, but with kids, they tend to point at the heart, or like, you know, me. And whereas adults, they tend to kind of, you know, some of them also point to the heart, but a lot of adults, they point to the head. So I found that interesting, you know, because we hear how the soul is situated in the heart, so kids kind of have a more intuitive sense that they're here. So anyway, so then usually they point their head. So then he asked them, okay, so what are you? You're your hair, or your head, or what are you exactly pointing? And then usually they say something, oh, the brain, I'm the brain. And then so he said, okay, well, if I were to like cut out that part of you and put it on the table, would that be you? You know, like separate your brain from the body, would that brain be you? And then naturally they say, well, be me, okay. So then he says, well, what is it then? And then they usually become bewildered, and they're like, well, maybe I don't know who I am, actually. And then he says, well, it's a little embarrassing, isn't it? You don't even know who you are. So it's like this progression where people can be convinced that, okay, well, maybe I'm not my body. I don't even know who I am. So we can come to that platform using logic. Okay, one, I exist. Two, I'm not this body. Then the next stage is trying to understand that we're not the mind. So we can convince people they're not the body, but I'm my mind. So this one will just have to require a little bit of introspection, but how you're actually just perceiving these mental images that are going through your mind. You're the perceiver, and you're just seeing these flickering images going on. And so you can, just through introspection, you can understand, okay, I'm different than those. There's the mind, and then there's me, who's the perceiver of those images. So like that, you can understand that you're not the mind. Then, next stage in coming to understand Paramatma is that you understand that the body is just working according to the modes of material nature. That your heart is beating, your blood is circulating, your digestion is happening. All the functions of the body are just kind of happening according to the laws of nature, almost like a mechanism. It's just like a machine doing things. Okay, I can understand that also, that this body is just kind of like a machine. So then after coming to that understanding, then you can understand, well, I'm not actually doing that. I'm not actually the one who is doing anything in this body. I'm not consciously thinking of, okay, heart, pump now. And, oh, blood, okay, you got to circulate. And, you know, I'm not consciously thinking about what's going on. It's just happening automatically. I'm not the one doing it. So that's kind of like the fifth and perhaps final stage where one can realize, okay, well, if I'm not doing it, then somehow it's happening. And one might come to the conclusion that, okay, well, and it's not happening in a haphazard way either. It's actually happening in a pretty organized way. And I'm not the one doing it, so maybe there's some other intelligence involved that's making this work. So like that, you can come to understand Paramatma, how Paramatma is actually making the body work. Like one example, simple example is like speech. When we're speaking, automatically grammatical sentences are coming out. We just have like an idea in our mind, and then without us thinking too much about it, having so much conscious awareness, all of a sudden these, you know, sentences are coming up, you know, well formulated, understood by others, and we're not consciously aware of choosing which words we're going to put in which order. They're just coming out. So that's interesting, because how is it happening? I'm not conscious of it, but it's happening. And, you know, like modern science, they don't even really understand exactly how that whole process works in great detail. But even if in theory you could understand all the mechanics for how speech were to come out, you still wouldn't be able to explain how one's not consciously aware of the speech that's coming out. How there's no conscious involvement for how it can come out in an organized way. Well, you could say that the brain is kind of like a computer program or something. It's just a mechanism. It's something which, you know, can spit out perfectly grammatical sentences. You know, it's organized in a specific way where just sentences come out, like a computer program. Like if you... Computer programs, they can carry out complex tasks. But one can ask the question, you know, one can ask the question, well, if a computer program can carry out some complex task, well then, how did the computer program get organized? And then, well, you come to the conclusion that, well, there's a programmer who has intelligence who organized that computer program. And we can understand that there's a difference between that programmer who organized the computer and the computer itself. So similarly, we can understand that there's a difference between whoever organized the brain and the conscious self, I guess. Because the conscious self has no understanding of how speech works, so it won't be able to organize the brain in such a way that the brain can produce, you know, intelligible speech. But the super soul, you know, he can do that. So he's organizing it, and then the intelligible speech is coming out. So anyway, that's kind of another way we can somewhat come to the conclusion that, okay, there might be some other intelligence involved beyond just my own. I'm not doing it. Some other intelligence is involved in this process. So like that, you know, I exist. I'm not the body. I'm not the mind. Material nature is working, and I'm not the one doing it. So it's kind of like the progression that Prabhupada gives in that purport of the second canto. And when Madhavendra Puri was here, he also kind of gave an interesting little analysis of kind of like a proof or some kind of evidence for the existence of Paramatma, super soul. You know, he talked about vision information processing, which, you know, he got into a lot of details about how the eye works. You know, you have this visual field. Like right now I'm seeing the wall, devotees, I have this the lights. I'm seeing a visual field in front of me. And the retina in the eye, it's coding that visual field in terms of action potentials. So action potentials are just voltage spikes per second, like electrical impulses. Light is, you know, working with the retina in such a way, and then the retina is coding that into electrical impulses, which then travel down the optic nerve, which is the thing connecting the eye and the brain. And then those electrical impulses in units of voltage per second, you know, how many impulses per second, are going to the brain, and the brain is presumably processing that, and we can see. So that's basics how it goes. And then the way the retina sends these codes, the visual information field, into action potentials, and it sends it along the optic nerve, which is made of a million neurons, which are just like long strands of cells that are like act as conduits to transport that electrical signal from the eye to the brain. So then when neurons are excited, they exhibit like somewhere up to like 100 voltage spikes per second. And when they're not excited, they generate like few voltage spikes per second. And then depending on how excited the neuron gets, it can exhibit any number between 3 and 100. And there's a million of these things in the optic nerve. And all of these, each neuron has a specific number of voltage spikes going back to the brain for processing. So, for example, like let's say and I'm looking at this visual field right now and I see the clock. It's 8:08. The time is 8:08 right now. And, you know, that colon between the 8 and the 0, there's one little colon there, which might be like 1 pixel in my visual field. You know, that's about right. Maybe 1 pixel or like the center of that little dot in one of the colons on the time maybe is 1 pixel. And then the one neuron in this optic nerve is coding that pixel in terms of a specific voltage spikes per second, which could be like 78, for I don't know, whatever. Could be some number of voltage spikes per second. And then that information is going to the brain, and that's just one little pixel. And there's millions, so many pixels that I'm seeing in my visual field, and all of them have a unique, some kind of number associated with them of voltage spikes per second going to the brain. Another thing that makes this interesting is that that's just with one visual field. Then if I turn my head and, oh, you know, I see like a whole new visual field, all the neurons, they just change their numbers of action, you know, of voltage spikes per second. And even more surprising than that, there's no time lag in my conscious experience of my visual field and the data input. Like, you know, when I turn my head like a computer, right. There'd be a little hourglass, and we'd be there. You know, it'd be taking a lot of time for the image to change. But there is no detectable time lag in our visual fields. So this is an interesting phenomenon. And this is not just true with vision. This is all of our sensory inputs, like, you know, our auditory, olfactory, and tactile senses. They all work in a similar way. So this leads to a little bit of a problem. If we're conscious self, if we're conscious living, you know, we're spirit souls, completely different than the brain, how is it that there's such a clear correlation between our conscious experience of, you know, perhaps visual fields, and how the brain is acting electrochemically going on, you know, like, there's certainly some correlation there between how the brain is acting and what our conscious experience is. So how is that, what's that interface look like? And we know that we, the conscious selves, are not capable of not only reading millions of numbers of voltage spikes per second just coming through the optic nerve, let alone all the other senses. We're not able, we have to not only read that, but we have to understand what it codes for. So as conscious living entities, we're not able to do that. It's just not within our power. We're very small, very tiny. We don't have the power to be able to understand all of that. But somehow it happens. So there has to be, we're not doing it, it's being done for us, so there's some agent that does that for us. And characteristics of this agent are that, one, it has to be conscious, because in order for it to give us conscious experiences, it has to understand consciousness. And it also has to have the power to be able to understand millions of bits of information simultaneously at all times, forever. So this is the way this is described is that this is Paramatma who's doing this. So one might come to the conclusion that, okay, a super soul or Paramatma might exist through mental speculation. That's the conclusion there. So that's easy to understand, more or less. Then there's Durgyayam, understood with great difficulty, and this is Bhagavan realization. So the reason it's difficult is because we're trying to engage in mental speculation to understand Bhagavan. Then it is understood with great difficulty. You can't understand the Supreme Lord by mental speculation. You know, Krishna does so many bewildering things that if you just use your faculty of mental speculation to try to understand it, you would be totally bewildered. Like Queen Kunti prays this way in her prayers. You know, she says, oh, although you are unborn, you take birth, you know, and especially your childhood pastimes, they're the most, to me, they're really bewildering. Fear personified is afraid of you, you, Krishna, are afraid of the stick, this little stick that Mother Yashoda has. And you're really afraid, like you're in tears and your mascara's coming down and you're shivering, you're like totally afraid of this stick. But yet fear personified is afraid of you. It's totally bewildering to Queen Kunti and, you know, to somebody. Because Queen Kunti understands that Krishna is God. Whereas Mother Yashoda, she's not as bewildered, but she doesn't see Krishna as God. She sees Krishna as my child and children. More, you know, they behave like they might be afraid of something as silly as a little stick. So she wasn't bewildered by the fact that she wasn't thinking about God's position, you know, oh, this is God or anything. So because she wasn't bewildered, she could understand Krishna. So therefore, she's actually considered to be more exalted than Queen Kunti in that sense. So, and then, you know, also, like, you know, Mother Yashoda and the gopis, like, they'll clap and they'll try to encourage Krishna to dance, you know, and Krishna's a kid, you know, you can dance. And then so Krishna will dance and he'll sing very loudly and he's acting just like a puppet in the hands of the gopis, you know, and the gopis are having fun time getting Krishna to dance. And sometimes Mother Yashoda, she'll ask Krishna, can you go bring me that wooden plank or some wooden shoes, or the wooden measuring pot. And then Krishna will go over there, and he'll try to lift it up, but you know, he'll try to lift it up, but he'll just stand there because he seemingly can't do it. And then he'll like hit his body, and he'll, as if like, I have the strength to lift this, you know, which is totally bewildering to anybody who's looking. Like, this is God, he can't even lift a wooden plank. It just doesn't make sense. The whole reason he's doing this is to please his devotee, because it enhances the love that Buddha has for him, and he's just doing it for the pleasure of his devotees. So the Lord is the Supreme Lord in all circumstances, whether he's playing like a child, or he's lifting Govardhan Hill, or maintaining the whole universe. He's the Supreme Lord in all circumstances. So, but in the next purport, we'll hear how, although this subject matter, a Bhagavan realization, is difficult to understand, it becomes easy to understand if one follows the prescribed method. So the prescribed method here, if you want to come to Bhagavan realization, is engaging the senses in the service of the Lord, specifically the tongue, and chanting Hare Krishna and taking Krishna prasad with a spirit of service. So just minor detail. With the spirit of service, you do these things, and then it becomes very easy. So I think I'll stop there. Does anyone have anything they'd like to add? Luke?
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Ru. On the topic of Adhavendra Puripu's discussion of the working of the eye, you mentioned like the logical conclusion one would come to is, okay, because I can't process all of this information, then somebody must be doing it for me. So I remember reading Prabhu's discussion, and he mentions this very common material-minded argument. Oh, well, you know, I'm doing it unconsciously or subconsciously. I'm doing it, but I'm not aware of it because, you know, it's just one of the many subconscious functions of the body. But in the paper, I remember reading that Madhavendra Puripu points out that it's a very unscientific argument, and he gives the example, one could just as easily claim that subconsciously I'm maintaining the planets in their orbits. I'm doing it, but I'm just not I'm subconsciously, you know, or mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So, they have a lot of seemingly good arguments, but then...
Yeah, or just they'll say that it's a mechanism in the brain. It's just, okay, whether you're unconsciously doing it or not, basically they're saying that it's just a mechanism in the brain that's doing this. And they'll give the example, well, because if the brain gets damaged, then my speech is impaired, for example. Going back to the speaking example, the brain gets damaged, then I'm not able to speak. So therefore, the brain is like a mechanism of speech, which, you know, there might be some connection there, but it's certainly not. It doesn't explain how the brain got organized in the first place, or how one can be conscious of how consciousness can fit into that whole picture either. So that was kind of like the point.
Just a comment, since you were talking about languages, an article I was reading about consciousness recently, and it was talking about how the machines or robots using artificial intelligence, they may be trained to recognize many languages, but so far they haven't been successfully able to train a machine to learn a language on its own. So that ability to learn a language is not there. I mean, it cannot be somehow programmed. It's just interesting.
Yeah. We'll see how that field develops of artificial intelligence. Because, you know, the brain works a lot like a computer in one sense, so that you can theoretically have a machine, like if you're looking at sunset over a mountain with snow peaks on it, and then theoretically you can understand, you know, I can understand how they might develop a machine that can look at the same thing and describe it in just as good detail as you can describe it. You know, like it has just the same number of pixels and whatever to be able to perfectly describe that scene as you do. You know, like it has a little printer that says, okay, there's red rays coming out from the top of the mountain peak or whatever, and you might be able to describe the same thing. So what's really the difference between you and the machine? What's that? Well, sure, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, there's some consciousness there. There's some feeling. So. Okay. Yes?
There's two states of realization, very difficult to realize, which is Bhagavan, and easy to realize. And this verse is for the easy to realize stage. The next verse is the more difficult to realize. And you were describing how bhakti is, we always hear bhakti is easy, and yet the realize of Supreme Lord is more difficult. I think those two points are actually non-contradictory, because the process of realizing Brahman is easier, not the process, realizing Brahman is easier than Bhagavan, but the process of realizing Brahman is more difficult. Mm-hmm. Whereas the process of realizing Krishna is easier, but gaining the realization is more difficult because it's in Krishna's court. Mm-hmm. If you have sufficient strength, you can realize Brahman and Paramatma on your own strength. But even if you have sufficient strength, you can't realize Bhagavan because the ball is in his court. He can choose to reveal himself or not reveal himself, even if you have all sorts of qualifications and so on. So in that sense, it's more difficult because he has to extend his shakti to you by which you can. So the ball is kind of in his court despite your capacity. Whereas in Yogamara, Ganamara, if you have sufficient capacity, which is a big underscore in the if, but if you have sufficient capacity, you will realize Brahman and Paramatma for sure, because it just entails an increasing of the sattva-guna. Like that. So
that's a nice point. Okay, is there anything else? Okay, we'll end here. Thank you very much. We have a brahmachari meeting downstairs after this, 5 minutes. Okay, Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai.